KUAC looks about. KUAC looks about.
Today's program consists of excerpts of Governor Jay Hammond's address to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, July 28, 1975.
Now, one of the problems which has engendered a great deal of controversy and public indignation is, of course, the so-called legislative pay raise. And I recognize full well the popularity of vetoing that measure, and believe me, I was sorely tempted to do so, particularly upon learning that there were other elements incorporated in that bill which are far more abusive, quite frankly, from a long-term financial point of view than the simple legislative pay increase. And that is the so-called legislative retirement system, which expands substantially the legislative retirement and relates it primarily to that provided the judiciary. I find it curious that there has been little public hue and cry over the years over a rather lucrative judicial retirement, which obligated no contributions whatsoever. As a matter of fact, this bill, for the first time, obligates a 7% contribution on the part of the judiciary. So, in essence, you might say it brought down slightly the judicial retirement, but it escalated very substantially the legislative retirement. Now, I found that it included myself in that. I hadn't thought it did initially. It provided that it was not only for current legislators, but for all elected officials. So while I had told them that I would veto the bill if they had not excluded me insofar as a salary increase was concerned, in essence, that bill does very favorably impact myself from the standpoint of retirement. And I would hope that that consideration engenders a great deal of support on the part of the public to repeal that particular aspect of the bill. And I know certain quarters in which it truly will. But it can be argued that actually the pay raise was perhaps the longest, most overdue, least inflationary, and less expensive of any public employee, state public employee salary increase incurred during the past five-year period of time. Believe it or not, it averages out to less than 9% per year cost of living increase. So those who felt that the legislature warranted some $9,000 salary here 5 years ago, and incidentally I did not, I traditionally have voted against all legislative pay raises because I think it improper to either provide them with the opportunity to raise their own pay or the obligation to do so. But be that as it may, to those who supported that at that stage in time, I suppose we have to agree that even legislators are impacted through cost of living differentials. And as a consequence, that amounts to little less than 9% per year. Now, I had said that I, insofar as state employee salary increases were concerned, I would countenance nothing more than a cost of living increase. Well, that tacitly suggests that I would not veto something that held within that guideline. And the legislative salary raise did so as well. They removed myself from the pay raise, which I had asserted I would veto the bill upon if they did not. Now, the reason for me removing myself from that was not because of any self-righteous or self-denial desires or machismo or call it what you will, but simply the recognition of the fact that the administration obligated to negotiate with state employees under the Collective Bargaining Act, or the Public Employees Relations Act, as it is properly called, would totally destroy any credibility on the part of the administration if my salary were escalated automatically by any benefits negotiated by those state employees negotiating with us on salary increases. In other words, hit me again, fellas, it hurts so good. Every time you win a point, my salary goes up. Forget it. But I think that we're going to have to look very closely at not only the so-called legislative pay bill and the elements incorporated in that, such as the retirement I mentioned before, but also the impact on state government of the Public Employees Relations Act with its right to strike concept, which was passed in 1972, and what has transpired since insofar as impacting the state treasury. The record, I think, dramatically demonstrates that something had better be done shortly, or we can forget all about sometime in the not-too-distant future $1 billion rolling down those pipelines providing a good life for all Alaskans and doing something significantly more than simply funding an expanding, ever-expanding state bureaucracy. Now, if we simply repeal the Public Employees Relations Act of 1972, we'll be back to the old system which prevailed, where they had to go hat in hand to the legislature and plead their case, which, while better than what we're confronted with now, still does not assure the public employee that his legitimate concerns and needs will be accounted for. I frankly think that something by way of a statutory mandated cost of living increase be structured into the law. Again, that poses problems, I recognize. Maybe that isn't the answer, but I think it's obligated we come in with some type of substitute to assure their concerns are taken care of. The other feature of the bill that passed, however, I think I mentioned that it provided an increase for supervisors that were not represented by bargaining units, and that we were finding that subordinates were earning more money under the salaries negotiated by collective bargaining than those people supervising them. And something has to be done to make sure that this doesn't transpire. What motivation is there to assume a supervisory level if you're going to make more money in the process of taking it? So in the final analysis, I concluded that there was only one major inducement for me to veto the legislative pay bill, and that, quite frankly, was make Hammond look good. And Lord knows I could use a little of that upon occasion. But nevertheless, I think there are overriding statewide interests that I would not change that decision. I still think it was a correct one. The other items that perhaps we should touch upon here would be, I know one item of concern I notice on your list here is the so-called mineral severance tax. While I am assured that we could exempt everybody who's involved in the mining business now in Alaska without doing violence to prospective future revenue earnings, what about the Mitsubishis of the future and those large corporate interests that, if we don't assure some type of revenue engendered from their activities and the ensuing population increases and service requirements, we may find ourselves in a very unfortunate situation in which Alaskans are not deriving from the exploitation of their natural resources significant dividends to make it all worthwhile from their point of view. Now, again, I would welcome any input from those involved in the mining industry as to how we can at once accommodate the little guy, the mom-and-pop operation, the homegrown Alaskan mineral activities, and not in the process permit a monstrous ripoff, which has occurred in more than one enterprise in Alaska's past, and including the fishery, in which I've been intimately involved. I think we're confronted with this type of thing when we look at the severance tax imposed on gas at this stage in time, the difficulty of extracting adequate revenues to offset the costs of some of that activity, because simply we find that in the Anchorage area, the average Anchorage gas user would be affronted by any additional tax on gas, since, of course, he'd be asked to absorb it. And despite the fact that absorbing it only impacted the average Anchorage household by some $10 a year, it made it politically untenable to attempt to extract a few more cents in the way of a gas tax. So because of that, accommodating the Anchorage gas user, we find that foreign corporations are getting essentially, or not a free ride, but certainly are paying far less by way of revenues into the state coffers than should be the case. I think we're going to have to look to a diversification of revenue resources. We found it too easy to draw upon oil as simply the means of funding all state government programs. I think we're going to have to recognize that other ongoing revenue engendering measures are going to have to be undertaken. I've suggested that that which causes impact should pay for that impact. If we need another $4 million in alcoholism programs, we should then boost the alcohol taxes accordingly. If we need more monies for road maintenance and expansion, perhaps a gas tax is the right route to go. But I can assure you we're very sensitive to your concerns in that regard. There's no intent on our part to wipe out the fledgling mining industry within the state. But I certainly want to get the handles on foreign monster corporation activities that otherwise I'm afraid will escape with what properly should be Alaskans' dividends. The Trans-Alaska Gas Pipeline is another item of serious concern to many of you I know. And while we hear at many points that, well, there's no sense of exhausting yourself in regard to arguing that case because it's a foregone conclusion, it's going through Canada, I don't buy that. I think, frankly, that there are greater arguments, substantially greater arguments, in behalf of an Alaskan route now this year than there were a year and a half ago. I think they relate not only to emerging situations in Canada, but I think the end product of our task force approach to the problem, which said we're going to sit down, we're going to evaluate the facts before we make a decision, rather than making a decision and warping the facts around to accommodate it, gave us far greater, more credible arguments in support of a Trans-Alaska route than prevailed a year ago. And I can assure you that these arguments will be mounted with the FPC through our legal counsel in Washington. I think coming in with a two-pronged, both environmental and economic argument sustained by data and support from both environmental and economic quarters will go a long way to furthering Alaska's case. Now, that isn't to say that it won't be an uphill battle to sell. I think the delays in the FPC hearings indicate that in all probability, we'll find that it may well be a congressional determination. And if that be the case, of course, it's necessary we sell this in the national forum. And we feel that one of the best ways of so doing would be to utilize the best talent we have available, the most credible talent, and also bracket both the environmental case and the environmental and the economic, by using persons who are intimately knowledgeable in both fields and accepted as experts in both fields. We feel that one of the best advocates for the Trans-Alaska route that we can mount from an environmental point of view or acceptable in a conservationist quarters is the Lieutenant Governor, a man of international and certainly national name familiarity. And while we can mount all sorts of economic arguments in behalf of an Alaskan route that go over well in Alaska, it's going to take something substantially more than that to persuade people outside to contact their congressmen and tell them that they favor a Trans-Alaskan route. It's been suggested that some other prominent Alaskans embark upon that endeavor, and I couldn't more wholeheartedly encourage that. I think Wally Hickel certainly could do a great deal on the national forum to further the Trans-Alaska route, and I would encourage him and those that would support that effort to do so. The expressions of various conservation groups during a recent appearance I made in New York, quite frankly, was very heartening, and that virtually all so represented came out unanimously in support of the Trans-Alaska route. Now, perhaps for different reasons and motivate others, but nevertheless, I think we are uniquely confronted with a situation where we have the so-called developers and conservationists, and I don't like to use those titles because I think we're an admixture of both, but nevertheless, those identified as what might be termed both ends of that spectrum have come out in consensus on that matter, and I think we should take every advantage of it. We intend to do so. I might comment on one rude rumor that's running about the country at the moment that I'm not sure how it got started, the suggestion that with Secretary Hathaway's resignation that I might be contemplating responding to a request that I consider a Secretary of Interior slot. I might point out first that there's been no one close to President Ford who has made this suggestion, and any speculation in that regard is certainly most presumptive, and that furthermore that I had stated during the past campaign that there were three things that I wanted to assure the Alaskan electorate, unlike my predecessors, and that was that I would not return to Washington, no matter how President Nixon urged me to do so, nor would I dismiss all Republican cabinet members upon assumption of office in Juneau, nor would I stand on the podium and sing, "Please release me." And I can assure you that I still abide by those decisions. So I might say that in response to the questions of some as to how I like the job of being governor, that I wouldn't trade the job for any other in the world. And I'd like to point out, in view of the lucrative Retirement Act that the legislature just passed, looks like I won't have to. Thank you very much.
Excerpts of Governor Jay Hammond's address to the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce, July 28, 1975. This is Jeff Kennedy. Thank you for listening.
This has been KUAC Looks About. The University of Alaska sent you this program.